Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, our neighbor, Dr. Gerald Bell, is known across the world for his leadership training sessions. And I learned that approximately 500,000 managers in more than almost 5,000 different organizations have experienced the Bell leadership experience.
And the world is still afloat in spite of that.
But Jerry, you're gone so much and you're gone all over the world visiting with leaders, not just the top leaders of the top companies, but with people at every level of organizations, trying to help them understand themselves and become better leaders. Along the way, you got to be learning something every day new about leadership.
Profoundly exciting and fun and thrilling, and I wished I didn't have to go to sleep because of the—
Do you really?
I know you do, and you need about 8 hours of sleep to function and be alive, but—
You'd rather be working all the time in this work.
It's play. It's not work.
And why?
The discoveries and the changes and the opportunity to make a difference in the world and feel alive and see the beauty of human nature and humankind and the complexity in the problems is profound.
But after inspiring 500,000 people, I mean, don't you run out? I mean,
you think so, and sometimes you get tired. But from experiences on a daily basis, that talking with people are profoundly bright and complicated and doing great things and discovering. And we have a mixture of world events. The emergence of leadership has really been an evolutionary process. It's always been apparent. But the nature of the world, I think, has become profoundly much more complex. And if you had to predict the next 1,000, 2,000 years, the trend of complexity will increase. So if you think about the 1900s, 1800s, a farm— maybe 80%, 60% of the population were involved in agriculture, small, pretty much individual producers. The world was relatively simple. It's just gone crazy with complexity, and the consequences of that are the invention of the newness in technology, the interdependence of the world, the globalization, and has caused everyone to become visible. So human beings now pretty much can't behave without others experiencing the consequences of their action. And then we need to all human beings are more dependent on getting others to do things, from doctors, teachers, plumbers. And so all human beings end up being leaders, even though many don't want to be or don't think they are. So a homemaker, a construction worker is a leader. They can't
leadership in this phase of leadership is being able to encourage or persuade people to do what you want them to do. Is that
and to get people to help you personally survive and to contribute and succeed and be happy. So you really have a difficult time living in interdependent complexity if people dislike you and don't believe in you. So even as you would well know, teachers are profoundly wonderful and talented in kindergarten. If you're an abusive parent and harass the teachers, they unconsciously can't help but be less effective with your own children. So even though I may not be in a leadership position, my ability to relate effectively and influence people positively, it causes feedback for me, and this is one of the consequences of everybody.
What's the difference between just ordinary the fundamentals of salesmanship versus your idea of how this translates into leadership?
Well, it's a continuum. It's you basically are selling people to help you, but if you consciously are calculating to get them to do something, usually they'll perceive you're using them, and they'll be smart enough to realize that, and they'll give you less of themselves to help you. So it's got to be an authentic, genuine behavior toward all people. So it's a mutuality. It's what everyone knows, that the emergence of the future of all leaders, I think, is that you have to, because you're visible, that everyone sees your results, that the consequences you produce, if they're not contributory, if they don't help others in the process of helping yourself, you lose people who will follow you or support you. So in the old model of selling, of talking people into doing things that might be against their own best interest, will cause you to fail in the current world and in the future.
Well, does a leader then have to, in every case, pay attention to the needs of the people that he or she is trying to persuade to help?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely. And I think one of the emergents for the current and future leadership is the fact that you have to, because you're visible and your results are visible, you have to start paying more attention to how you affect others and how that then causes them to behave toward you. So if you want to just be selfish, you should be devoted to contributing to others. So the models of servant leadership, the models of creating an organization with a worthy and noble mission are the best way to make money.
When I was growing up, we sort of thought that the leader was the person who knew better what was needed to be done and would tell us what to do, and we would follow that lead because we trusted the leader or because it worked better, whether we agreed with him or not, to do what he or she, or usually he back then, said. And that was pretty good leadership because they took us to where we needed to go, or at least as we saw it.
Positive directions, yes. Well, I think that's certainly the case. If you study all primitive tribes, they had a wise man or woman. And what is wisdom? And the wisdom is a person who collects significant principles or laws of behavior and survival and effectiveness. And so the premium on becoming wise, really smart and experienced and savvy, thus the premium on learning, is greater today even than in the past. So you not only have to take leadership and set a direction and take ownership for stepping forward and leading, but you really have to have your judgment based on wisdom and not on narrowness or dictatorial conclusions or arbitrary beliefs. So it's got to be really information-based, data-based, experience-based. So by all means, the wiser you become, the smarter the leader you become, the more effective you will become. But that being said, that leaders who are then dictatorial destroy their followership and teach people who follow them to basically be unwise because you're taught not to think.
It's interesting to me. I've just saw a business leader that I've had come to know and admired have the rug pulled out from – I mean, he seemed to embody all the great aspects of cooperative, considerate leadership. Yeah. Yeah. But sales went down, so he got canned.
Yeah.
And so the board of directors was not interested in leadership qualities. They were interested in results.
Right. And that certainly happens. But if the leader was doing a great job and the economy crashed or they made a mistake, the question is whether the board made a mistake. Great leaders who use great processes of leading produce the very best results consistently over time in the long run. So if you go from the current great teams for many years, the Detroit Red Wings in hockey, the San Antonio, great basketball team, and the Spurs and Carolina, of course, and all of our great teams, that they have a tradition of great leading. And you can't, if you lead well, it doesn't mean you guarantee you'll win or create great sales, but it puts you in the highest probability position to do
nothing,
that.
So no guarantees, that good leadership is always successful. And you might have bad leadership that in certain times comes up with a good result. But you're just – so you don't say it's absolute, but that the probabilities are enhanced.
Absolutely.
Like in basketball, the probabilities are increased if you've got Dean Smith or Roy Williams or Mike Krzyzewski as your coach. You may not get the national championship, or you may increase your odds
profoundly. It's exactly right. And it's really fascinating along what you're saying, DG. I had a great experience. Recently went to basically the graduation ceremony. We have a wonderful program in the business school. We got a world-class dean of the business school, Jim Dean.
Well, we used to have that dean, but he's going to be it's he's a got sad, a new job.
Sadness for the business school, but a great selection for the university. He'll make a marvelous contribution and help our new chancellor greatly because he's got his feet on the street and knows the practical dealings of the university and the state, and is just a profound leader. But he led the business school to start something called Leadership Initiative. It's a seven-week elective, the second year MBAs take, and it's very selective. So about 30 of them get into it and or choose it. They presented 5-minute intervals their conclusions of what they learned during this immersion. That's all they did was study leadership. And I watched and I was thrilled. They first of all of them, I think, to a person, were unconsciously and consciously saying they really wanted to be a great leader. Not just a producer, but to know the profession and art of leading. And they also realized the power of feedback. Each of them said they never understood they did this. They didn't realize they impacted people. They didn't think they could do this. So the thrilling thing for me, that the great leaders love feedback, and they all experienced that. And the third thing they talked about was they discovered themselves. And I think the thing I was happy about, they seem to be on an increased pursuit of knowing themselves, because you can't be a great leader unless you really understand yourself, your strengths and your weaknesses and blind spots. And so building yourself is a premium for leading and thus being effective as a human being. And all of them talked about the value in this program. They each have a mentor, an experienced, wise, mostly ex-business leader who coaches them and gives them feedback, counsel. So all of them walked away saying, I want to do that, and continued it. So if you have 28-year-old, 30-year-old, the best and the brightest, being humble enough to say they need help, want feedback, and love to have mentorship, the world will be in a good place, because these are the types of people who will lead us into good things.
We're visiting with our neighbor, Dr. Jerry Bell. We're talking about leadership, and he and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Dr. Jerry Bell. We're talking about leadership. For those of you who joined us late, Dr. Bell is the longtime, the organizer, founder of Bell Leadership, and now... As we mentioned, 500,000 people have benefited from his instruction. Some of them, Jerry, I'll have to tell you that the one of the nicest compliments I ever heard anybody give somebody else talking about your training is not the right word, your sessions. Mm-hmm. Her company had paid for it. She was overwhelmed. She wants to get as much of Jerry Bell as she can. She said, I'd even pay for it myself. And, a lot of companies are sending people to you for leadership training. Well, isn't there some risk companies, you can have too many leaders, can't you?
Well, yeah, that's certainly an assumption. You can have too many chiefs. But I think that is a mythology. Too many chiefs means that you have too many people who are a little bit closed-minded or pig-headed or can't follow. You can't possibly be a great leader unless you can also follow. So one of the characteristics of the best leaders in the world is that they're humble and modest, contrary to what was taught or exposed in early years. Or you'll get a lot of people who become successful short-term or impactful who are completely arrogant and cocky and blind to their own weaknesses. they are usually overwhelmingly a poor leader. They may make a lot of money or do something else, an individual performer. Could be a scientist, artist, athlete. The best leaders in the world are humble and modest. Why in the world would that be the case? Well, they end up getting feedback. They know they make mistakes on a daily basis. They see their own weaknesses. And even though they make a ton of money, get a lot of praise, get a lot of visibility, a lot of power, they end up shielding or shedding a lot of the flattery so they don't get caught up in a bubble of thinking they're better than they are. And they also know what they screwed up and messed up.
When you're called on at the highest level, I mean, I want to talk I'm more interested in the low-level training, but let's talk about the high-level of counseling, training, coaching that you're called upon to give these people who for one reason or another, are at the top. And based on your experience, you know they're not perfect, that they have that there are things that they can do better. But how I mean, when you walk into the guy's office and he's called you in or his board has called you in to counsel with him, how do you introduce yourself?
Well, normally they have some expectations about me, or if I'm just meeting someone for a new time, first time. Most leaders have so many complex, overwhelming problems and challenges. They also were anchored with a really big problem, is that the more power you have, the more influence you have, the bigger the leadership job, the fewer people you can talk to. Because if you say something, you're the CEO of IBM or Bloomberg, who went a great North Carolina University graduate, Peter Grauer, is the chairman, is a wonderful leader. But if he or the Apple CEO confides in somebody they work with or in the community or in the business world and says, I'm thinking about reorganizing this, buying this, selling this, that would be news in 6 seconds. So they have an extreme difficulty of thinking out loud, of brainstorming, of testing ideas, of having somebody they can talk to who they know will not tell a soul, who's also had enough experience to understand both business and organizations. So if I can demonstrate to them that I understand the problems and challenges they face, and then I'm trustworthy, and also know enough about what their life's like, they will tend to talk for hours nonstop.
Mm. So a person at the top has nowhere to go structurally for the kind of guidance that that would be a necessary aspect for the full performance. Yeah. No coach. It goes back to my limited experience. As a lawyer, that there were lawyers who were the general counsel for a company who developed that sort of relationship with the CEO.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who and very much like a Brack Shell was one of these lawyers in Greensboro who the boss could confide in, get good, solid advice. The other – help me with this. I'm sorry to interrupt. The other is that structurally in the corporate world, in the old days, you had a board with a chairman of the board who was there to provide guidance to the president, who was the chief executive officer. And now we've just had this brutal shareholders contest
with Jamie Dimon,
who thought it would be an insult if he had a chairman to work with him. Right. He had to be in total charge of everything.
Uh-huh.
And
So
what you might provide is for someone like Jamie Dimon who doesn't have this structurally, he's rejected the idea that he would, but if someone of his choosing that he had confidence in that he could unload on might do a better job.
Right. And I think those who know Jamie Dimon, and I've talked to a lot, say that he is a very, very good person, noble. He's certainly been experienced enough. You had a wonderful senior executive tell me, we're talking over two candidates, which one to hire, and he was commenting on one of them as, who was slightly younger, say in his 50s, and he said, I just don't think he has enough sadness in it, behind his eyes yet.
Is that right? Oh, what did he mean by that, you think,
Well,
Jerry?
And he meant he hadn't seen the complexity and the brutality of making mistakes and doing a great job and then getting blindsided or making a strategic choice. Like the leader of the ex-CEO who just was fired from JCPenney's and his three leaders were brought in, he now has a lot more sadness behind the eyes, which is really wisdom building because he made a massive mistake, cost JCPenney's $4.3 billion in 18 months of leadership. Good intentions, smart guy, had been very successful at Apple, but he tried to apply their strategy to a business which it didn't apply. But he is now much more humble.
So he's better. You think he's a better leader now than he would have been had he just had a roaring success with Penny, with the new
pretty expensive
Penny.
Tuition.
Well, he didn't pay it.
It would have been nice if he had been one of the MBAs who had been out either on a ropes course or an experience and had a coach tell him, look, you better be sure that you go out and study J.P. Penney's customers before you try to make them like an Apple store. And they might have and suggest, I don't think this necessarily was the case in his particular situation, but an older, wiser, experienced person can give you feedback that may soften your overconfidence in your own opinion when you're younger. So wisdom is built by tremendous amount of mistakes, and to be a great leader, you've got to lose your fear of being wrong.
Well, Jerry Bell, so going back to the setup originally, when you go in to talk to one of these CEOs, probably chairman and president of a big company, and you're there to help, your idea is that what this person needs, and maybe I'll be the right person, maybe I won't be, but I might be the right person for him to share his concerns, his problems, the kinds of things that he can't share with his business associates because he may feel that they may lose confidence in him if he's struggling with something.
Well, that is an assumption. Actually, what happens if a senior leader shares his or her doubts or insecurities, usually it makes the followers trust him more and admire him more. However, the challenge is, let's say a senior leader has, it's dealing with his or her direct reports, and I do things like I'll have them rate each one on how competent they are and how much they trust them to be able to give them more responsibility. So if I'm talking with Jamie Dimon over the division heads of different parts of the bank and he wants to talk about the London leader who had the whale, the trader who lost him several billion dollars. So who can he talk with who would both have enough experience but also that would not have difficulty keeping that silent? So it's the higher you go in a business, it's unfortunately it can be a very lonely job because there are fewer people you can talk to. And fewer people really understand what it means to have the pressure of if you make a mistake, you just cost JCPenney's $4.3 billion, 25,000 jobs, and all the stockholders losing dividends. And so one of the main challenges of leaders is being able to enjoy responsibility rather than stressed by it.
Well, we're visiting with Jerry Bell. We're talking about various aspects of leadership. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with my friend Jerry Bell. And we're talking about leadership, which he knows something about, having trained. I learned at the Bell Leadership has inspired a 500,000 people. scary.
Lots of them. Yeah.
Well, we talked about the challenges of providing valuable assistance and counseling to people at the highest level, but you're also engaged in helping younger people at lower levels in the organization, at every level in the organization, do a better job by being better leaders. And so, how can you help people who are new to a business?
Yes, that's actually a fascinating dilemma. And I've made a rule for myself. I always have to, every year, make sure I do enough work and involved with entry-level workers, laborers. And right now, for example, I'm working with a client where I'm training union members in a heavy-duty manufacturing, old-time company. And I don't get paid as much to do that as I would with CEOs, but I sit with them and spend days listening to them and talking to them and understand them, because I always want to make sure I understand the consequences of leading with a CEO for everybody who lives, as well as all human beings. So what you do, they deal with exactly the same issues, like communicating and leading and working and motivation and conflicts and technically doing their job well, but it's a different order, and they have less ability to control what they do.
Well, this is great to mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about what you do with a union worker in an old line manufacturing organization. I mean, I start out as a skeptic, and I say all that guy has to do is to do what his foreman tells him to do, and to do it right, and go home and forget about it, and then right. come back and do the same thing the next day. What's wrong with that model?
Well, that it's certainly the older model, and there's a lot of truth to it. The lower level of your job, the more it's controlled by technology, the less discretion you have to make judgments, to decide what to do. So it's constrained. So the ability to change things is low, or make improvements. But unions or laborers in non-union organizations, they have a major set of rules and practices and procedures, and they're fighting for equity for workers and fairness and compensation. And so they get into struggles with management of just in communicating and understanding and just normal human dilemmas. But people who are doing labor jobs are really enormously good people who most of them want to do a good job. They take great pride in doing well. They also take great pride in working together and being successful. So they like all of us, want to be valued and respected and feel worthy.
So what are the challenges of coaching or teaching people at this level?
Well, it's to get them to focus on how they can improve themselves, given the constraints and limitations. If they've got a bad boss, they have much less ability to influence the boss. They tend to focus so much on what happens to them, what others do, that they struggle with saying, well, okay, I'll work on my ability to communicate, but what's the use of me doing it if my boss calls me names and harasses me and tells me to disregard what the top management says and do it anyhow? So it's a struggle. The less discretion you have, the less you focus on what you can do to improve your own skills. So it's an unfortunate dilemma.
Well, it sounds to me like you're struggling with this
It's painful. It's sad. And so the great news, though, it motivates me and teaches me. I can go and work with the CEO of that company, which I do, and the senior leaders.
And say, I've been down in the where you haven't been lately.
Exactly. And here's what they say, and here's what they're experiencing. Mm-hmm. And in this particular situation, I've worked with the CEO for many years, and he's had the privilege of helping him through his career. And he's moved from a middle-level manager to become an extraordinary, great leader of a big billion-dollar public company. Well, and he believes in building all the people in the organization.
We're visiting with Jerry Bell. We're talking about leadership. Jerry Bell and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I've been visiting with Dr. Jerry Bell, our neighbor in Chapel Hill, widely respected throughout the world as a authority, as a teacher, a trainer, a coach in leadership matters if you join us late. I was bowled over by this half million figure of people, not just that you've indirectly influenced, but people you've had a direct impact on. And Jerry, I don't have the right question to ask you, but what I would really like for you to do is just to, in this last segment, just to share some of your thoughts about leadership and how some of the things that you've learned working with these big businesses might help us to be better in dealing with our day-to-day challenges.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are two things I've been spending a lot of time thinking about with the privilege of doing so. One is the massive discoveries in neuroscience and how that affects human behavior and thus how it affects leading and building organizations and succeeding and contributing. And this quick summary of, I think, some of the most important discoveries in neuroscience, there are two of them. One is the discovery of the neuroplasticity of the brain and the discovery of epigenetics, which in simple form is that we have a new understanding. There's a much greater probability of changing people's behavior because you can increase the impact of changing their wiring to some degree. That we used to believe you were born, you're wired, that's it, game's over, ends up not being true. So most neuroscientists now say, look.
At any stage of life? I mean,
well, the older you get, the stronger your wiring, the more difficult it is, but
can you give an illustration of how someone's wiring might be changed?
Well, if you were the simple way to understand it, I think, is if you at an adult age became blind, your brain is still searching for inputs through your receptor cells. You can't get any more from your optic nerve, so it starts gathering information through auditory sensation, and eventually the growth of neurons and connections in your auditory system increase, you hear better. The same thing, that's why people can read Braille, and most people have ridden an elevator, tried to do it, and there's not a chance. But if you became blind, the increase in the circuitry and nervous system of your fingers becomes strong. You've been rewired. So if you were had a traumatic experience as a child, say your parent was an alcoholic and you were beaten, you've got wiring to you built a method of adapting to adults, which is fearful and protective, quotes a wiring, and you can desensitize that and replace that by constantly, repetitively changing your beliefs and behavior.
Well, and so a leader who understands this can search for ways in which some of his talented people who have problems can be, quote, rewired.
Exactly. And it gives you another hope of are people born to be leaders or not? And I think that's a wrong question. I think that's not a good question.
Why not?
Well, I think that all human beings are genetically created, designed, have in essence to be wired to be great leaders. I think the genetic foundation of human beings, almost all human beings, babies born this minute, have a need to achieve, to learn, to walk, to learn to tie their shoes, to read, to talk, etc. It's a born to achieve. And all human beings have a need to be loving and caring. And so we unlearn to do that. And all human beings have a genetic need to be creative and innovative and think unusual and different thoughts. It's in children, it's the ability to play. So raising a child is such a delicate process. No one gets a perfect childhood, but we know what is a healthy and effective person, so we can now learn methods of helping someone build themselves.
And are we at the beginning of this? Are we of this idea that we can transform people's wiring? Yeah. And so there are lots of things we're going to learn about how to do this, I guess.
Yes, exactly. I think this is one of the things that makes it so exciting to be alive today, the greatest opportunities and discoveries and learning.
Well, you've been thinking about this, and so you've got I've told you I wouldn't interrupt you too much, but now you've got me going.
I love
you've
it.
got a, you've got
I
a,
love
uh, a responsible person who's very talented, who's got some flaws in it that keeps him or her from being a great leader. And so you've got confidence now, hey, I can – if we do the right things together, we can accomplish some rewiring to overcome this
problem. Someone who has a hot temper or highly critical, I've got hundreds and hundreds of individuals who – pretty much all ages – who've changed that significantly. But in a lot of people will say, well, you can change a habit just 30 days. It's not a chance. It takes a minimum of 365 days, and you have to do something daily, repetitive relearning, reinforcement to cause the necessary possibility of change. So it's a relentless practice which creates
Thinking about golf, which I can't play, but I mean, I know that that there's a lot of coaching and changing strokes, and that when people are when the coach says you got to change your stroke, it's very painful, not always successful, but when it is, it can transform a person's game, I guess. Is that sort of the kind of thing?
Yeah, very much so. And most people probably don't change. And the main reason is they don't try. They give up. It takes too long and you don't see visible quick results.
Jerry Bell, we've got 2 or 3 minutes. And so I promise I won't interrupt you.
No,
just give us give advice to us now that you've learned dealing with 500,000 people. What are some things that all of us need to know?
Single most important thing I concluded from my humble experience here is that the smartest decision anybody will ever make is to build themselves first. There's nothing that you could ever do in your life that would make you have a higher chance of being successful and happy and contributory. And every 1% you can improve your personal effectiveness, you then multiply that times 100 people you meet with on a daily basis and the problem. So the worst mistake a human being can make is stay as they were raised and live their life with all of their weakness and strengths and thus suffer the loss of the missed opportunities. So the most effective leaders end up being highly healthy, have clean egos, have spent a lifetime learning who they are, understanding their weaknesses, and then when you understand yourself, you accept yourself and no longer hide. So smartest step a person could ever make is to invest in getting feedback and enjoying learning about themselves and take 15 to 20 minutes a day until you die studying, well, what did I do yesterday? How did I improve it? The most rare commodity human beings have today is their time. So great leaders excel in advanced time management. For example, a woman, a CEO, 92 years old, I believe, started the Golden Door, a health resort in Arizona, talking at a meeting I was at in San Diego recently on the Urban Land Institute people, but talking about her life. She's talking about similar things, and she said what she does is at the beginning on Monday, she looks back and says, what did I do last week? And studies how she spent her time, what she do, and then she plans the next week. And she thinks about, from her life, the thing you have is your time. And so when I think with executives, you got to budget your energy and your time as well as your decisions.
I love this, so that the idea is that she's reflective. Almost like keeping a diary, but a diary of that's purposeful in terms of I'm going to not just record this. I'm going to go back and look at this and coach myself.
Yeah. Well, you know how your time sort of disappears in a day, in a week, and you know if we look at what's the most precious asset I have, and I wasted about 4 hours. I can either choose to do that again or cut it down to 3. So our time creeps up on us, and the more complex you're, bright, sophisticated, someone that does what you do, you get so many invitations to do things. You got to be really careful about allocating your time.
Well, I also have to be very careful about allocating our time together, and it's gone by. It's been very productive, but I'm looking back at it thinking how it could have been more productive, Jerry Bell, thanks to your advice.
Enjoyed it, DJ.
Jerry Bell, a great trainer, coach, and student of leadership, has shared that with us, and we're very grateful to him. And grateful to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, Who's Talking, and I'll be back here real soon.